Bruce, I have a lot more to ask you about, too. You know, the Piano Puzzler is something that we know you from because we hear you every Wednesday morning on Performance Today. And but there's a lot more to your career than just the Piano Puzzler. Like we were joking about earlier, if that's all you had to do, you'd just be bored with
the... Well, you know, the Piano Puzzler's really emerged as a sideline. I mean, I'm... It's something I did for fun and to teach. The first time I did it, I was teaching theory classes at Juilliard, and I wanted to give interesting homework assignments. So I would say, let's take this phrase of a melody and everybody write it in the style of Brahms, and then we'd listen to some Brahms and talk about what that meant, and we'd evaluate and assess what we did. And then I'd ask them to take the same melody and write it in the style of, let's say, Stravinsky, and we would talk about that. So people really enjoyed those assignments. And I started to use that kind of thing to give lectures at Lincoln Center when I first got that job 21 years ago. So I would say, well, there's a piece by Bartok on the program and a piece by Beethoven on the program. What if they wrote something together? And I would write and make up something. Oh. And the audience would get a big kick out of it. It was more fun than a standard lecture approach. And Anya Grundmann, who was from National Public Radio, was in the audience for one of those, invited me to do one. And it led to two, which led to three. And then 11 years later, we're still doing them.
It's a weekly feature on Performance Today, and you say you have to fly to St. Paul to go record a bunch of them.
Yes.
All at once, and then they play them back.
They're not really live every week, but they
That's
are recorded live, of course.
Yeah.
Oh, it would be impossible. Basically, what happens if you want to be a contestant, you email American Public Media. Huh? They have a big website, and they tell you when we're going to do it, and then they call you. It's the same as Car Talk and everything else. They're
Absolutely.
Not. If they waited for people to call in live, what if nobody called? I mean, it would be a disaster. So you have to do a very short interview to make sure that your personality is such that you wouldn't be in complete silence, which is basically the only fear, as you know, of radio is total silence.
That's why we had our contest, you know, this week earlier to
yes.
get our contestants lined up, you know.
Right. You want talkers.
Yes, exactly.
And they were talkers. That
they
was
were great.
They were great.
April and Mary Ann and Jeff, thank you so much for coming in and being our contestants. They're sitting there still.
Fabulous.
Yeah. Here is our guest for Alaska Live.
Sorry, but so basically the puzzlers emerged on a side, and I've been a composer all my life, and I've written operas and symphonic works and chamber music. And
you've written pieces for Yo-Yo Ma,
yes.
Itzhak Perlman, mm-hmm. The Metropolitan Opera Guild. You have,
right.
you're not stopping.
No, I have a lot of major work that has nothing to do with my radio life. I was just in Lucerne where I had a premiere with the Human Rights Orchestra, which was an amazing group of musicians from the Berlin Philharmonic, the La Scala, La Fenice, all coming together for free for human rights. It was fabulous. And, you know, this summer I'm doing festivals in Vail, Colorado, and in Fort Collins, Colorado, a thing called Off the Hook. And when I'm not writing a piano poster, I'm working on, right now I'm working on an opera, which would be my seventh opera. And they've all been performed, and major companies, you know, the Washington National Opera and in New York, the 92nd Street Y and the New England Opera, et cetera. And the Metropolitan Opera Guild did a small opera of mine for kids, which was fun.
And so your operas are in English?
They're all in English.
They don't need the subtitles if you're an English speaker.
That's true. Although a lot of those operas that are not in English are pretty amazing.
We did go to see the Met, and we saw Don Giovanni at the Met this past winter, and it was amazing. There were fireballs on stage. I felt like we were at
the end. Yeah,
yeah.
Well,
a big
he deserved
rock
it, didn't
yes,
he? Yeah.
Yes. Yes, it was amazing. And why don't we listen to another one of your pieces? They're just really amazing works, and so you can pick one here.
Well,
Bruce Adolph is here as part of Alaska Live, and tomorrow Bruce Adolph and friends perform on the Herring Auditorium stage at 8 o'clock.
You know, it would be interesting to hear this short movement from a major choral work. It's actually a very big piece, but this is a short movement. It's called Consider Love, this one movement. The piece is called Reach Out, Raise Hope, Change Society, and it was written for the 90th anniversary of the School of Social Work at the University of Michigan. And this is, the again, another live recording. It's the chamber choir of the University of Michigan, and some musicians. It's a wind quintet and three percussionists.
Did they commission you to do this?
They commissioned me to do it to celebrate the 90th anniversary.
Wow.
And the text, this particular, each movement is a different text. This text comes from Dominique de Menil, who was a very important figure in both human rights and social justice. And she gave a talk in Texas where they have the de Menil Center. I'm not sure exactly what the name of it is right now. And she said, in a world armed to the teeth and ready to explode, perhaps an alternative would be to consider love. And I'm not quoting it exactly right, but you'll hear it when it's sung.
Yeah.
And the idea is that I gave the energy of a world exploding, but then when it turns into consider love, everything changes. So again, this is a live performance at the University of Michigan.
Okay. Bruce Adolph, that was a touching piece where you said it's called Consider Love, where it exploded and then it came back to the sense of peace.
Yes, the idea that, as the text says, consider love as an imperative need, which is not an easy thing to set. Consider love is easy, but as an imperative need, not so much. So I had to find a kind of a mood and a tempo where those words could float by without seeming too complex or academic. that was conducted by Jerry Blackwell, who is the director of choral music at the University of Michigan.
My guest today on Alaska Live is Bruce Adolph, right here on KUAC 89.9 FM and KUAC HD Fairbanks. I'm your host, Lori Neufeld. We took the first hour to do three piano puzzlers with our qualifiers, and that was a lot of fun.
That was great. They were fantastic.
And what strikes me is you've never done this before on the road, doing a piano puzzler live with the piano in the room and the guests in the room. And,
well, I've never done it with the guests in the room ever, because when I go to St. Paul to do the show, the guests are on the phone, and they're from all over the country. Uh-huh. So the idea is they should be home.
Right. In their slippers and with their iPhones in their hands, Googling things probably.
Right. It is difficult in a way to do it at home because you have to hear it on the phone.
I know. I wondered about that.
Yeah. I mean, I suppose they could hook up speakers, but they'd have to have a rather fine phone system to do that.
Yeah. And you can't have that feedback loop going either, so that would be bad.
No. Right.
So they have to listen over their phone to your piano puzzler and to you talking to them.
Yeah, it's tricky.
Yeah. Well, this is a really neat way to do it. And I felt like just a fly on the wall sitting there listening to what was going on. Mm-hmm. And it was so fun. Every once in a while I hear Fred Child does jump in and tries to help sometimes.
Fred is very good
at that.
He's
amazing.
Actually, I think he gets, if not every one of them, it's like 99%. And it didn't used to be that way when we started. He got better and better at it. And then he realized that, you know, it's like anything else. He's so used to the mood to be in, how to concentrate, what to focus on. And now he thinks they're all pretty easy. Once in a while, he doesn't get one. But it's very, very rare.
There, you said it's almost a curse now to listen to things. I had a listener call in the other day after he heard the promo for you coming on here and doing the piano puzzlers. Listener Kirk Vald called in and he said, in Bruckner's second, I hear Born Free.
Yes. Well, what happens if you do enough of these, as I do more than enough of them, it's fun, but it also means I often hear connections that are distracting from what I'm paying attention to.
I think you're passing it on to other listeners,
no,
too.
No. Well, you know, it is interesting. There are not that many notes out there and combinations. And there was a famous lecture by Leonard Bernstein back in the old days of the Young People's Concerts about the infinite variety of music, in which he asked some mathematician to give him, knowing the 12 notes and the 11 intervals and the possible combinations, and you're leaving out rhythm. Because that's totally infinite. But if you just look at pitch combinations, the number of ways that could be ordered and interval orders and then harmonic combinations was astronomical, you know, understandably.
Right.
But the connections are also many, many, many.
Yes. And, you know, and then there's octaves you can put it in. And so, you know, that's...
Right. But it's still, octaves only do so much. They can be effective, but...
You are here with, it's billed as Bruce Adolph and Friends for tomorrow night's concert. And I know Ann Bimmerman dropped you off here, and then she said she was taking your friends so they could go practice. So tell me about the concert and who you tour with.
Well, actually, one of the friends is my wife,
great.
The pianist Maria Stroke, who plays my music extremely well, knows it inside out, and Mark Steinberg, who actually... Now that I think of it, is my wife and I met through Mark Steinberg. Is someone
really?
He's a fantastic violinist, the first violinist of the Brentano Quartet, and he was my student in theory class when he was a kid. So I've known him since maybe he was 12 years old, and basically, Mark introduced me to Maria because Mark was playing concerts with her and recitals with her, and that's more than 20 years ago now, and. He's one of my favorite players because he's so imaginative and really gets inside the music. And I mean this in the best way. You don't think violin when you listen to him. You hear the music directly. You know, it's really about the piece. And the violin is no obstacle. He plays it fantastically, which is why he can do that. But some violinists are always showing off, you know, and he never does that. He always gets, it's like an actor who gets inside the character so much that you don't think that there's an actor anymore. And I really love that. And my wife's a fabulous pianist. And so I brought them along. that the first half of the concert is just piano posers. The second half, I will be introducing two pieces of mine, both of which are for violin and piano, and there's a Brahms second sonata for violin and piano.
Do concert goers get to play the piano puzzler?
Yes, the people who come can raise their hands, no calling out, raise their hands and be called on. They could stand up if they think that's more effective.
You're such a teacher, you, Bruce Adolph.
Well, you know, it's what it's all
that's
about.
That's great.
Really.
That's great. And so, wow, you have two grand pianos and a violinist. And so that's a lot of piano for Mark to...
Oh, we're only going to have one piano on stage.
Okay.
Because when they play, I'm not playing.
Oh, okay.
Maria's going to play the piano instead of me for those pieces. And I will be an audience member, which is my favorite thing to be when my music's being played. I like to listen.
A composer's dream to be right there when your music is being played.
It's not a dream. It's a reality. It happens all the time.
And you are touring a lot.
Yeah, I do a fair amount of that. I'm pretty lucky to get to hear pieces. Sometimes our composer is told we don't need you there, so we're not paying for your airfare. We don't want you to come because you're an extra expense. I just had a performance in Lucerne where they luckily did pay for me to hear this fantastic performance by a major orchestra there. And I'll be in L.A. coming up in October, actually, with the L.A. Chamber Orchestra, which has played quite a few of my pieces, and I'm looking forward to that.
Well, there'll be no snow there. We made sure that you had snow here so you could, you know, experience some winter yet.
It's fantastic. I mean, I just left New York where it's 70 degrees.
Yes.
And finally, after a very long winter...
Yes.
And I missed the snow. I got my jacket back out of the closet.
Oh, good.
Yeah.
Well, yeah, it's May 2nd, and we still have snow in the forecast for as far as I can see.
Wow. Amazing. Yeah,
I know. It's a strange spring for us.
Mm-hmm.
Let's listen to another one of your works. I'll let you choose another one.
Let's do Delightful Water, Delicious Water. Which the title...
I like the title.
Yeah, the title is from two paintings by Paul Gauguin. One painting is called Delightful Water, and the other one is called Delicious Water. And this is because I wrote a piece based on Paul Gauguin's diaries of his travels in Tahiti and his life there and his paintings. And I created a book for... mostly for kids about his life, but it's about his take on music. Because Gauguin... whenever he was attacked as a painter, which he was in the press and all the time, his usual defense was, if you think of my paintings as if they were music, and you think of me instead of as a painter, as a composer, then you'll understand what I'm trying to do. I'm not trying to be realistic. A composer is not realistic. So the colors don't have to be true to life. They have to be, as he put it, truer than life. And so I found his many, many quotes about music to be inspiring. And I felt I would turn it around and write a piece of music based on his comments about music and based on his paintings. So Delightful Water, Delicious Water is really built on the idea of water. So you hear a violin pattern, which you could imagine flowing, and then pulling out of that are little branches of melody. So everything is like streams connecting to the main river of the violin. And the other instruments are flute, clarinet, violin, cello, bass, and marimba. Very colorful. And it's really, I think, if you imagine how water creates little eddies and whirlpools, that's exactly what the idea of the music is.
Great.
Thank you.
if you like what you hear there, the delightful, let's see, I can't get the name of it right, delightful water, delicious water. You can hear pieces, maybe even that piece, but they won't have all the instruments there tomorrow night for Bruce Adolph and Friends. But if you like what you hear, I think you'll be able to hear much more of that music tomorrow night with Bruce Adolph and Friends.
Indeed.
Yeah.
Actually, what we're playing is a piece called Coyote Scatters the Stars, which is, both pieces are for violin and piano. That's a piece that is based on a Native American myth, which I'll tell the audience before the concert. And the violin and the piano sort of act out the story. And the other piece for violin and piano is called Three Secret Stories, in which I'll talk about the idea of narrative in music when you're not allowed to know what it's really about.
Secrets.
Secret stories. Which is a lot of music is just like that. You know, music without words, it's got its own secrets.
Yeah. And that's what's so interesting, to sit down with the composer. Here we have you here to explain what was going through your mind as your inspiration for that piece, Delightful Water, Delicious Water. It was paintings.
Paintings, but also the idea of water as a kind of catalyst for the technique of the piece. So I found a way of illustrating water, which actually is an easy thing to do with music in a way, because water flows and music flows.
But I was, the marimba even did the little
droplets. Water drops, exactly. Yeah. And the feeling there was that I didn't want to do anything in the piece, in that movement, that wasn't derived from the metaphor of water. So every little thing had to fit somehow like that.
You, seems like you think about music almost all the time, and you're not only a piano puzzler, and you've written books, like you said, you wrote a book for kids, and you've written other books. You are now doing research in the science of the brain and creativity and neuroscience.
Well,
tell me about that.
I'm composer in residence when I get a chance in LA at the Brain and Creativity Institute, which was founded by the amazing neuroscience couple, Antonio and Hanna Damasio. People who are interested at all in the subject probably know who I'm talking about. Antonio has written quite a few books. The earliest one, which was probably the big splash, was called Descartes' Error. And the most recent one is called Self Comes to Mind. And his books are written for lay people, but they're not that easy, because he doesn't dumb things down. He really just tries to elevate your thought process.
He's a neuroscientist,
He's a neuroscientist, but he's a brilliant writer. And it's very poetic, charming, and sometimes even humorous writing, but it's all very rich with science. So he and his wife, Hanna, started an institute at the University of Southern California, which is devoted only to researching how the brain is creative. And they've got a lot of great people working there. And I'm involved with the music research, not as a scientist, but as a composer and a musician, being a kind of an advisor and discussing things with them. And this goes way back, because I have been writing music based on ideas of Antonio Damasio for quite a few years now.
Really?
Yeah. And so that's how we met at a conference at the Aspen Institute in 1992. And that was just before his first book came out.
So have they been having you think about music, compose music while they're scanning your brain? Is that something
we haven't done that yet? Right now we're sort of doing, you know, it's very complex what you can understand and know, and it's easy to come up with what sounds like a wonderful project, but they're really hard to carry out, and if you're serious about the results. So we've done some studies, and we're developing a longitudinal study about children and music and practicing music. And there have been similar things, but this has some unusual components, following people as they grow up for quite a long time. And we did a study with Lori Rubin, who is a wonderful mezzo-soprano who's blind and has a fantastic storehouse of music in her mind. And I wrote a piece for Lori, which she wrote the text for, which we've been doing all around the country. And we used her as a subject to get an idea about the plasticity of the brain in someone born blind, how the brain, the 70% that is usually devoted to visual things, has been co-opted to sound. Nothing alarmingly new there, but when you have a great example of something, it's really interesting to study.
And have they been doing, there was a guest on Alaska Live, the bass player for Eel House, was talking about going into music and music cognition. And he was very interested in that. And he was talking a little bit about, you know, how we start using different parts of our brain with music. And
well, there it is a hot field.
Yes.
As it's all over the place. But it is true that the research is done and shows that if you start practicing music seriously, by seriously, I would mean with discipline, starting young, several hours a day, at least an hour a day when you're a child, and you do that for 10 years, that it's been shown that the brain's functions and structure actually become better, healthier, stronger connections. And it's been known for a long time that it affects everything else, all kinds of thinking. So in a way, studying music is a great way to sort of enrich and enliven your whole intellect. It's really a great thing to do.
And
it also prolongs life.
Yes. Yeah. And they've been doing some work with dementia patients,
yes,
where playing music for them and getting them to sing along or play along has been...
Well, it may be even more than that. There are people looking into Alzheimer's and specifically and music, and there may be some therapies that can come from this. And, you know, when a person with Alzheimer's will have very compromised working memory and short-term memory and sometimes long-term memory, but skill can be intact. It's possible to actually still play an instrument, even if you can't remember the music. You can mm-hmm. still experience it and perform. And there are great things that can be done with skill-based memory and music with all sorts of dementia.
What was it like in the Adolf household when you were growing up? Did your parents, because you have such a knack for the teaching, for the composing, for the exploring of music. I can only imagine that came out maybe at a young age.
Well, I think my father was interested in many, many things and really knew a lot about a lot of things. But
he was
not
a Renaissance man.
Well, he just was interested in many things and pursued them, you know, yeah. And he had books on everything in the house and... he sang really well. He danced really well. He didn't play any instruments. My mother also didn't play any instruments. But they did take my brother and me when we were very little to theater, dance, concerts. The idea was if you live in an area that has stuff, you should go see those things.
And that's the way I grew up too, yeah.
Yeah, right. And not just stay home and watch TV,
which
we didn't do. So the experience of live performance and lots of different kinds as a young person, I think it's fabulously stimulating. No amount of equipment in your house can substitute for being there when someone is right in front of you.
I remember that moment sitting at the symphony, and I remember that moment of being able to pick out, oh, wait, that's what the violin sounds like. Oh, back there, that's what the French horn sounds like. And I remember that moment of all of a sudden listening for the different... Uh-huh. Pieces and the instruments. And
I actually do not remember when that happened.
it was very interesting. We had seats that were very close to the the orchestra, and we didn't have, you know, that may not be the best sound, but it is the best view of for the musicians, you know, to see them. So
it's definitely something to do with our daughter, who's now 14 and a wonderful violinist, and she's also an actress, but. We go all the time. We go to theater. We're in New York, but we go to something, I don't know if it's every week, but in the last few weeks, she's been to 3 or 4 plays and 2 concerts. And you know.
When I emailed you the other night, you said, well, we're going to the opera, but I'll email you back tomorrow. And
right,
I was like, of course they're going to the opera.
All the time.
You know, it didn't even surprise me. Of course you're going to the opera. It's a weekday. Of course you're going to
the opera. Right, exactly. Yeah. Well, in that case... a very close friend of ours is Fabio Luisi, who's the principal conductor at the Met. So we do get a lot of free tickets, too. Oh. It does help.
Yes. your daughter is 14 and she has picked up the violin.
She's been playing since she was 4.
Uh-huh.
And she is a good example of somebody with a lot of discipline who plays a lot, and it's affected everything she does because she sees connections in everything. Her memory is extraordinary. She knows a lot of Shakespeare plays by heart and a lot of novels that she reads. She remembers everything in the books, and she reads very fast, and she's amazing in math, and it's just everything. And I think a lot of it does come from the early stimulation of really disciplined approach to practicing when you're a child.
music and math go together.
They do.
And the grasping math, complicated formulas and stuff is a lot like figuring out how music goes together.
Yeah, and a lot of it is unconscious because, you know, the music and math connection is not one that is ever talked about in music lessons, really. It just happens.
You might scare kids away when you say, you know.
Well, I think most musicians couldn't talk about it because they're not really that involved with the math, but it's there.
Yeah.
And so she has always found math to be quite easy. And her math teacher, I know this is Alaska, so we're safe, thinks that she's totally involved in math and loves it and thinks about it all the time. Actually, not so much. She just finds it easy.
That's great. The West Valley High School concert band and some of those folks went to Lincoln Center and performed on Carnegie Hall stage
this
past winter. And they were just here for Alaska Live a couple weeks ago. And their experience there was really amazing. And they won a spot there on stage.
Yes, the band, I see this often outside too. A lot of bands from around the schools around the country show up at Lincoln Center or Carnegie Hall, various places around the city. But it's also very common for them to be in nice weather, outdoors on the plaza, yeah, playing at Lincoln Center. And little crowds gather and wonder who what's going on here, you know. And it's fun. And you can see a banner from the school.
Yeah.
That's a nice tradition.
That, Bruce Adolph, you work there at Lincoln Center.
I've been at the Chamber Music Society of Lincoln, yeah, Center. Now I'm in my 21st season. And basically, I give lots of lectures there. And I also interview composers, guest composers. And I run the family concerts, which I started that program there almost about 20 years ago.
And by family concerts, it's something that would appeal to all ages.
Yes. The idea of the family concert is that you should bring your kids to the concert. And they're an hour long. And they vary, and sometimes they're about one composer, sometimes they're fantasies, sometimes they're plays. And there are characters that I play, like Inspector Pulse, Private Ear, who is an investigator of musical conundrums. He's like the counterpart to the piano poster person.
Yeah.
He's more fun for kids. And he is always, you know, he has a stethoscope and a magnifying glass, and he's always trying to figure out how a piece works. And sometimes piano posers get thrown into the show.
Oh, great.
And all the musicians have to act, too. They get scripts. And a lot of the great young musicians we use are much more comfortable playing an incredibly difficult piece of music than saying three lines. But they get it by the time we're on because they don't do that usually. But
no,
what happens is I work with them for while they're in residence for a year, the young musicians. And when they leave, they are really comfortable doing that. And it's a whole crop of young musicians who are very comfortable speaking to audiences and playing characters even.
I find that here sometimes when musicians come in, they're so nervous to be on the radio.
Uh-huh.
And I say, you're not nervous to be on stage in front of hundreds of people, yet here you're nervous to be on the radio. They're like, yes, totally different. Totally different.
Well, everything's different.
You know,
and
it is.
They have to talk. Some people, mm-hmm, don't like talking. Mm-hmm. In fact, some people are in music because they're not verbal, and music answers all their, you know, it's their dream come true.
Okay.
And so suddenly faced with talking, they don't like it. You know, that does happen.
It does. Mm-hmm. Should we listen to another piece that you've brought in? You sent me some compositions of yours, and we've been enjoying them peppered throughout this Alaska Live.
Well, how about something very serious now?
Yes.
Here's a movement from my fourth string quartet. It's called Whispers of Mortality. And the movement is really about disease and illness. And you can hear exactly what's going on because the first violin is, you can think of as a person who is sick. And there's a lot of outrage and violent outbursts in the first violin. The cello represents the disease. And the second violin and the viola often seem to be the tick of time. So right at the very beginning of this movement, if you think of the back and forth pendulum swinging of a clock, you'll hear the second violin and the viola representing time passing. The cello is very ominous and represents illness, and the first violin is angry and fearful and represents the person who is sick. And with that in mind, you can follow this movement. It's very dramatic. And it ends I won't describe the ending, but it ends in a way that I only could have thought of if I was thinking of this scenario, because it's not any kind of normal musical ending. It is what might happen in the theater if these were four actors.
Thank you.
that does leave you just kind of hanging. All of a sudden, that piece ended, Bruce Adolph, like you say, like a act in a play might end.
Yeah, it's a scene in which the anger and fear of the violinist, or the character represented by the violin, is just an outburst. And if you think of it as a musical structure, it's very strange. But when you think of it dramatically, it makes perfect sense.
And you said dramatically, that told the story of an illness or a disease.
Yeah, right. It's the cello is the illness and the violin is the person suffering. And the second violin and viola are time passing. And actually, that's the second movement of five in, wow, in this piece, Whispers of Mortality.
And that's the second movement. So yeah, the illness is really taking over. And
yeah, what happens is in the third movement, it's there's this. It's very short, and it's this whispering, quiet music that is coming to terms with illness. And then the fourth is a wild, tempestuous sort of last attempt to struggle over, get through it. And then the last movement is kind of. I guess you would say it's acceptance and trying to come to terms with fate.
Mm-hmm.
And in that one, which we don't have here, but in that one I wrote a double canon, meaning that there were two melodies. Each one is imitated at a distance in time from itself in the four instruments. So to the first violin and the viola are playing one melody, but in imitation. And the second violin and the cello are doing another one, and they interweave with each other and create a sense of a web where you're caught and you can't get out.
The fifth movement's almost like the hospice movement where we're just making it comfortable,
right,
to go.
That's right.
Yeah. Wow, that's an amazing work. I know, you know, we've listened to all kinds of your compositions. Some have been so joyous and they've told a story too. And that one was heart-wrenching and scary even.
Yeah. Well, you know, I don't try to categorize what I'm doing. I just, each piece is about something and that thing has to be somewhat real for me.
Yeah.
Even if it's a piece for kids that's fun. I mean, I have lots of fun pieces for kids, which can easily be found online, like Tyrannosaurus Sue, a Cretaceous Concerto, which is the story of a dinosaur, and Red Dogs and Pink Skies, which is what the movement Delicious Water, Delightful Water came from. That is a piece called Tough Turkey in the Big City, which is kind of a fantasy about a turkey who becomes famous and gets to be in the Thanksgiving Day parade
in New York.
Yes,
could be,
but when he goes back to the farm, the other birds don't believe him because they didn't see him on TV.
It is so fun, Bruce, to have you here talking about your music because afternoon concert, we most of the time don't get the composer here to tell us about. Imagine that. You just don't usually get that. You know, we have liner notes, which liner notes are good because it tells you a little bit about what the composer might have been thinking about when they wrote the work. But we don't usually have the composer sitting here telling us about the work. And it's such a neat moment.
Oh, thanks.
Yeah.
Well, it's always fun to do.
You're on the Polyrhythms label, and Polyrhythms is that the name of your parrot?
Yes. I have a number of record labels. I mean, Polyrhythm is my own label, which only has a handful of pieces. I mean, it's named after my bird, Polyrhythm. But I spell it with two L's instead
of
one.
Who takes care of your bird when you're gone?
Well, there's always somebody there. Right now, okay, it's not just my bird, but my daughter who's there. So we have a friend who's an opera singer who, Lauren Skuse, wonderful singer, has come into New York from Detroit, leaving her own three children and husband and her mother to fend for themselves. And she came to look after both my daughter and my bird while my
wonderful
wife and I are here.
I bet they're doing some really fun trios then, the Polyrhythm,
the parrot, and the violin.
And two
a small green singer and a regular-sized human being.
So your small green singer, does it pick up some of your compositions and go with them?
Well, you know, he's 47 years old, and
amazing.
I've had him.
And what kind of parrot is it?
It's an Amazon. It's really a Panama, but it's people always say Amazon, which because that's the general look, which is green with a little yellow and some red. And he sings a lot of operatic selections fragments of opera, famous pieces, and some jazz and talks. And he does a cat and a dog and a cappuccino machine. And the only thing he does that I can't stand is a smoke alarm, which is he does it as loud as the smoke alarm. And that's terrible. But everything else is fine.
Because they learn from what's in your environment. And so this tells me a lot about your household, that you have a cappuccino machine at your house.
We don't have a cat or a dog, but he has met cats and dogs.
Uh-huh.
And he very quickly found the sounds intriguing.
Yeah, my dog met a parrot that hung out with a lot of dogs, and he didn't know what to do because the parrot barked at him.
Exactly.
And he just kind of looked at it and walked away.
Right, right. Yeah, parrots they're funny that way.
How fascinating. How long have you had it?
I've had the bird since I was a little child.
Oh, my goodness.
The same bird. Yeah, so it's a lifelong pet, you know, and they can live to be 100 years old. So you never know what's going to happen.
Well, it's great that your daughter is growing up with polyrhythm, too, because, you know, she's...
She might have to take care of him. It's difficult with parrots, though. They're not like dogs or cats in that they really only like one person.
Who's its favorite in the family?
Yes, which I've had the bird, you know, all his life.
It's you.
And so he sings and talks and plays with other people, but he won't let anybody else pick him up or pet him.
Uh-huh.
I wish I could tell him that for his own good, he should do that.
So you can walk around your place with your bird on your shoulder. And
sometimes
you can
do that.
Yeah. Duets with him.
Yeah.
Does he ever sit on your shoulder as you're composing?
No, because whenever he hears any music at all, he starts singing and talking, and it's really can be annoying. So I try to have him somewhere else when I'm working.
Because you guys might not be on the same page, so to speak.
Well, he often goes into his favorite licks, starts singing something he knows well, and I've heard these things before.
Yes. What are some of his favorite pieces?
Well, he does fragments of Mozart, the Queen of the Night is one of his favorites. And I've heard him do little bits of Strauss. Most of the opera he knows comes from when he was 3 months old, where he was hearing recordings in my house, and they were mostly Beverly Sills, Ellie Ameling, Teresa Stratus. So he sounds very good. But he does a lot of the same things over and over if he gets started and excited, you know?
Yes.
And it sounds great, but it also is repetitive. And if I'm working, it's a problem. But so I just put him on the perch somewhere else. And then
you've left him with an opera singer.
Yes.
He may have a little bit of a new repertoire when you get back.
He might.
You never know.
I love it when there's a singer in the house because they communicate, you know, and he's very good. So they probably will do some kind of duet every day.
Yes. I've seen on YouTube, I've seen some birds even dancing. Is he one of those that has some rhythm?
Most parrots dance. Mm-hmm. Yeah, they move to music quite easily. The one you're referring to, the really famous one on the... it's absolutely true, everything you see. But what they don't tell you is that there's a person also dancing in front of the bird. So the bird is kind of imitating. That doesn't make less of it.
Yeah.
I think they should have let you know because in some ways it makes more of it because the bird is also social and communal.
Yes.
My bird was featured on National Public Radio years ago singing along with the Queen of the Night sung by Natalie Desai. And the fact of the matter is when they recorded the bird, there was no recording. He just happened to be doing that anyway. And then we decided it would be interesting for the audience to hear how it fits together with the actual Mozart. And when they played the recording with what he did, it matched very well. Plus, he was doing ornamentation on top of it. So what he did was actually more amazing than the recording because he was doing it without hearing anything.
Right. Because he had no accompaniment.
Yeah.
He was just...
Yeah. Mm-hmm. He does have perfect pitch.
And do most parrots have perfect pitch?
I have no idea.
Right. I guess it depends on what they've grown up with. If they grew up in a household that was all flat, then...
Well, yes, you can hear birds singing on YouTube and other places who have terrible voices, or it sounds like either the owner or, in this case, he sounds like some top quality recordings that he knew. So,
is this a pet that your parents bought for you? And
my grandmother, my mother's mother, had a parrot, and that bird died when I was 8, and I was very upset that bird died because it was visiting all the time. And so after we bought a minor bird that we found to be not so friendly and not as interesting as a parrot, it was a family pet. And the bird selected me right away because they always pick one person. You never know who it's going to be. It's totally up to the bird. And I think it's because I was at the piano a lot and the bird liked music. So I became his person And so when I was older, he had to come with me.
And you were at the piano from a young age, and so,
yeah. Well, by the time I was eight, and we, or I guess close to 10 when we got this bird, music was already very serious. I'd been composing, and it was very serious for me.
Wow.
I think the bird knew that.
Yes. I'm going to hang with this guy because he does what I like.
Right, exactly. And perhaps, you know, he was probably thinking of his career.
Yes. I already know some opera, so sounded good.
Yeah, right, exactly.
You're judged by the bird. That's almost a...
That's what it is. Parrots are judgmental.
Let's hear what's next of the recordings that you brought with you, Bruce.
Well...
Can you read my handwriting?
Yes, I can. I didn't know I sent you this. This is great. This is another Brentano string quartet movement. It's come from a larger piece called O Gesualdo, Divine Tormentor, which is another title that needs some explanation. Don Carlo Gesualdo died exactly 400 years ago. This is a big celebration, or I should say a commemoration of his death and his celebration of his composing around the world. He was a obviously late Renaissance composer in Italy who really developed an extreme musical language that's even today sounds somewhat modern harmonically. His music has a few chord progressions scattered through almost every piece that could have been by Debussy or some, perhaps Wagner or some even, there's a connection with Schoenberg. I mean, it's very, very out there music. And it, those passages that are like that are because he's setting texts about death or about really seriously unrequited love, you know. He's also famous for killing his wife and her lover, the Duke of Ferrara. But he actually was not the only Italian Renaissance composer to kill his wife.
Oh, well, of course not.
I mean, in those days, it was not illegal to kill your wife if she had been unfaithful.
My,
in
how Italy. Far we've come.
Yes, right. In fact, the Medici family's favorite composer, Tromboncino, killed his wife, and he was briefly put in jail. But he was needed by the Medici family for a wedding because they wanted him to write music for a very important wedding. So they got him out of jail, and he was officially forgiven so he could write for the family. Gesualdo was related to the Pope. There was no chance, and he was a prince. There was no chance that he would ever get into any trouble. And it was also, as I say, it was legal.
Yeah.
In fact, it was more than legal. If your wife was unfaithful and you could prove it, you almost had an obligation to kill her. And often killing the lover got you into more trouble, but that was also understandable. Just like, you know, in France, the crime of passion was an excuse. If you were passionate for a reason, then your crime was forgiven. So,
and it shows up in Shakespeare plays and over, of course, and music, and yes.
Yeah, it's got a long history, and... The reason I mention it is that for many people who know the name Gesualdo, that's what they know. Mm. And there was some false scholarship that said because he was a cold-blooded murderer and therefore a sociopath and psychopath, his music was naturally going to be crazy and bizarre. Mm. But in fact, as I say, his murder was not the murder he committed, the two of them, were not considered sociopathic. This was a time when people would walk down the streets whipping themselves because they were, you know, flagellants, part of the Catholic Church at the time. It was very violent. It was a very kind of violent period.
It's good to put it into historical context.
Exactly. And so, the music he was writing was like that before this murder. And he continued to develop it in a very conscious, deliberate, and intellectually aware manner after that. There was also a school of composers influenced by him. None of whom murdered anybody, you know, so they weren't sociopaths, and his music caught on a little bit.
Right, without the murders catching on.
Right, the murders did not.
Okay.
And there's a new book out, it's about a year old now, called The Gesualdo Hex, H-E-X, by Glenn Watkins. And this is a fabulous book about the rare phenomenon of a composer 400 years ago whose music is still inspiring living musicians today to try new things. Because his music, when people first hear it, it changes their whole view of music history. How did this person write this music in the 16th century? It doesn't seem possible. And then if you don't know about it, it starts a desire to view the history of music and other histories not so linearly, but to see that it's about individuals and individual imaginations more than it is about some idea of progress that can be tracked in a simple way, which is how we tend to view history. music history, art history, and history in general, as if there's some kind of obvious line, which is really not true.
It's a continuum.
Yeah, there are things that you could trace, you know, but and there are things that make sense, but it's much more interesting to look at the reality of all these individual brains and these imaginations. So this piece is one movement of a longer piece, but this is the only movement in that piece where I wrote completely original music, because all the other movements are either Gesualdo's music arranged or Gesualdo's music somehow transformed into something new. This takes a piece of his called Moro Lasso, which means Alas, I Die, or I Die, Alas. And I called it Moro Less, which looks like Moro Lasso, but in English. And it's also because it's more or less based on the ideas of the music. And it's a completely different take. But the most dissonant and the most upsetting sounds in this piece are very close to being actually Gesualdo. So it's jazzy, it's a little funny, but it's also painful, and the influence of his music is throughout this little piece.
I'm so interested to hear this.
Played by the Brentano String Quartet.
that was a little bit disturbing, even, Bruce Adolph. That's a composition that you put together. The name of the composer, again, the Italian composer?
It's based on music of Gesualdo, Don Carlo Gesualdo. And as I was saying, he's a Renaissance composer who really created a new world harmonically. And in some ways, it's out of time. A lot of his harmonic ideas, his chord progressions, are so modern and so eerie and strange that they are more closely related to Schoenberg and sometimes to Debussy than to anything around his time.
Yeah, 400 years ago.
Yeah, there were some people who imitated him after that. And it was in Italy in the late Renaissance, there was a tremendous amount of experimentalism in music, including with quarter tones and things that you wouldn't expect, that people think are 20th century phenomena, but they're not. I mean, they are, but they're also earlier.
The sounds in the middle, kind of the shrieking of the strings, that sets a mood.
Yeah, well, there's meant to be a mixture in this piece of comedy and anxiety, basically. And the comedy is only because I thought it was interesting to take his most famous madrigal, not that it's his best, because they're all great, but the most famous one, Moro Lasso, and to first kind of stretch the chord progressions and slide around with some glissandos and kind of, it's almost like feel my way to it. And then eventually it gets jazzy and then it gets serious and becomes kind of disturbing. And I hope it brings people to Gesualdo as well, because he's an amazing composer. All the music is recorded over and over now. There are a lot of performances on YouTube. There are lots of great recordings available by Italian groups, Dutch groups, some American and English ensembles.
Wow.
And also some great books on Gesualdo.
Bruce Adolph, this 2 hours has just flown past. I can't believe that we're already at the end of Afternoon Concert and Alaska Live. To have you here doing the Piano Puzzler live with our contestants and our qualifiers was so fun. Huge thanks to Jeff Iverson, April Gillette, and Marianne Babbage coming in and braving the Piano Puzzler live on air with
you. They
did
very well, too.
They really did. And Bruce Adolph, it has been a pleasure to have you here, and we'll see you on the Herring Auditorium stage tomorrow night at 8 o'clock. It's Bruce Adolph and Friends.
Yes, thank you. I look forward to it.
And a huge thanks to KUAC intern Robin Wood. And thanks to UAF Music Department for the use of their Steinway piano, Jacob McToxin for volunteering to help move the piano to the studio and back, and Ann Biberman from the Fairbanks Concert Association for bringing Bruce Adolph and Friends to Fairbanks and transporting Bruce Adolph here physically through all the road construction and parking issues that we have here on the UAF campus.
A puzzle in itself.
That is a puzzle in itself, that's for sure. And for KUAC's Alaska Live, I'm your host, Lori Neufeld. KUAC's Alaska Live series of live music and conversation with local and visiting artists is provided by a grant from Design Alaska, Design Alaska, Architecture and Engineering for the New Frontier.